This is Dr. Richard Varun, and we're starting another session with Ambassador Fong. It is October 1st, 9:25 a.m. On the Texas Tech University campus. And Ambassador Fong, let me ask you, we ended up our session yesterday discussing Saigon in the 1960s and talking about Ngo Dinh Diem and his policies and his the coup that took him out. Let me go back a little bit and ask you about the Buddhist protests. It reached what was called crisis level in 1963. What you were there in Saigon, and you witnessed this, you heard about this. Could you tell me a little bit about your impressions of what was going on with the Buddhist protests?
Well, I think that the general impression of the people in the cities, because I doubt very much that the people in the rural areas were very, you know, aware of what was going on. Mm-hmm. It is just political things going on. And the Buddhist so-called revolt, that time was the kind of manifestation of the objection by so-called Buddhist groups,
right,
you see, against the kind of very repressive regime of President Ngo Dinh Diem at that time. So it would be interesting to understand first how was that regime of Ngo Dinh Diem considered repressive, oppressive at the beginning of the 1960s. And then you see why the Buddhists had that kind of manifestation and revolt. Why not the Catholic revolt?
Right.
Why not the Wahao revolt or the Kaldai revolt?
Right.
First of all, you had the Buddhist so-called revolt because it was more or less generally accepted that the overwhelming majority of the Vietnamese population were Buddhist. And so the kind of Buddhism which existed and still exists now in the East and the Far East, as you know, the Oriental civilizations of the Far East did not have any proper religion. It was a kind of Confucianism, it's a kind of philosophy, but there was no divinity.
Right.
And they relied on the yin and the yang of Taoism and so on and so forth. So when Buddhism came from India and then mixed with those traditions and customs of the Confucianist teaching, you see, in a process of osmosis, it went into the traditions and customs of those people. So, in a way, you say, why the Buddhists and not another religious group? And in fact, the Wahao, the Kaldai religious sects were much more, shall we say, active in the political spheres than the Buddhists.
Yes.
See? So suddenly you had the Buddhists. So I think, first of all, we did not have any political parties proper. There were some traditional Vietnamese political parties called the patriotic parties of the Vietnam Working Day, which would be some kind of a Kuomintang of the Vietnam. And then you had later the Dai Viet of all those patriotic personalities standing, being up against French rule and so on and so forth. But they were no match to Ho Chi Minh and his communist group. And so the problem, and it had been throughout, shall we say, 3 decades of dispute and conflict in Vietnam, you must have some kind of organized mass, you see, in the Vietnamese population. And so Ho Chi Minh and his troop tried and were able to have some kind of organized, you know, movement against French rule. And then later on, in their fight for what they claimed to be independence and sovereignty and so on and so forth for the Vietnamese people. So you had the problem of, should we say, organized mass groups in Vietnam to become a political force. See, there was not really any political force deep down in the people. Those patriotic political parties were rather of the intelligentsia, of those who were educated, who were aware of, shall we say, the oppression by French rule, colonial rule, and so on. And so the Buddhists offered a kind of organize mass, you see, for the Vietnamese to manifest.
Mm-hmm.
You see. So that why that was why you had that the Buddhist so-called Buddhist revolt, and then there was also questions that those Buddhist monks, mm-hmm. you see, priests, they were not very political. They had never been political before,
right.
You see, and suddenly now they become a political force to object against the repressive regime of Ngô Đình Diệm. Many people, whether there was not. You know, some foreign intervention or participation or encouragement in there, and you had a very well-known the Buddhist monk Thích Trí Quang. You see, many people asked the questions whether he was not a CIA agent or not. And so, still now, nobody knows really. But
I was thinking when you were saying that perhaps instead of being a CIA agent, or maybe his encouragement came from the North to further disrupt the government.
For Ngô Đình Diệm, mm-hmm. he thought it was from the North.
Really?
You see?
Okay.
But more and more, we in the South, because he remained and then he participated in lots of things, if he were the communist agent, he was able to camouflage it very well. But more or less fit with the accusations that it was more of an American-inspired thing,
mm-hmm.
It cannot be questioned that some of those Buddhist factions receive financial aid from the Americans, and that it can be proven.
Okay.
See? Whether they were really CIA agents or not, something else. But that is not the real matter. The matter was that they took to the streets mm-hmm. and manifest. And that played into also the hands of people who were against the Ngô Đình Diệm regime. And it helped the generals of Saigon. And in a way, it was also, shall we say, useful for the American authorities to put more pressure on Diệm for reforms, you see. But the man was completely, insensible to all those appeals
mm-hmm.
because of various reasons. Mm-hmm. So, it was clear, even to the American authorities, that the Ngô Đình Diệm became more and more repressive. Why? Was it necessary for Ngô Đình Diệm to be repressive? You see? Mm-hmm. So there is the question.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Vietnamese communists will accuse him of being repressive because that's probably the nature of the regime set up by the Americans, you see, in order to establish American rule
mm-hmm.
on the Vietnamese people. I don't think why, Diem should be repressive. If it were not, to protect, defend, safeguard a regime which he considered to be better than the regime offered to the Vietnamese people by Ho Chi Minh, you see. And then, was it possible for Ngô Đình Diệm to use other means, other policies, to deal with the disruption, with the sabotage, with the terrorism mm-hmm. imposed on the Saigon government at that time,
mm-hmm.
see? Was it possible for him? Would it be possible for him to be more liberal and more, shall we say, democratic in
right.
inverted commas
right.
to win the mind and the heart of the Vietnamese in South Vietnam rather than have his law of October 1959 to cut the heads of anybody related, even slightly to anything communism.
Right.
And so, and it was also an interest to have a look. At that time, there were lots of the people in the Saigon intelligentsia very close to Diem, related to the regime, who objected to his repressive methods. That was the Caravelle group, mm-hmm. as we know, that
right.
Hotel Caravelle.
Right.
So that is Nguyen Lu Vinh, Trần Văn Đỗ, and so on, who were for many times the foreign minister, and he was also the representative of Diem as foreign minister at the Geneva Accords in 1954. these people were very intimately related to Jim and were not blindly behind Jim and objected to those methods and repressive measures against anything against his regime, not only the communism, because that law, October 1959, in fact, in practice, turned out to be a repressive policy against anything disrupting the regime in South Vietnam, not only communism. So to be anything anti the regime would be considered equivalent to communism, you see. And then at that moment also, you have people like Nguyễn Hữu Thọ and all those who joined the so-called National Liberation Front of South Vietnam, you see. And those people were also very close friends to that caravan group people, you see. So why, you ask yourself, that they opted to go into the maquis, into the jungle, you know, to start a resistance movement. Right? So you have there almost the same people, and I doubt very much that they were communists. Some of them were, of course. But it must be objectively said that the NNF would not have survived or come into existence really in a meaningful manner without the help of Ho Chi Minh and his group in Hanoi, you see. That would be another group, you know. And I doubt very much that the large majority of the people in the countryside, in the rural areas, and the ordinary Vietnamese in South Vietnam were very much aware of the fight, of the issues, and then of the National Liberation Front. Because no one had organized, you see, that population politically. And you can always claim that they were against the repressive regime of Ngo Dinh Diem. That would be not entirely false, see?
Right.
And so that was the opportunity.
Do you think it was possible for Diem to be more quote-unquote democratic in his dealings with any opposition groups?
That is a very difficult question, because it was not a spontaneous, reaction or opposition to the Diem regime. It was, in my opinion, a very well-planned, calculated, program set up by Ho Chi Minh and his group. You know, logistically, it must be. You cannot do anything besides that. And then, there are now other difficult questions to answer, which would then bring in the American intervention, you see. The question you asked me would be the same that I would have put to Washington at that time, you see. Would it be possible to have Jim or anybody else, to adopt other ways to deal with insurgency and the beginning of what was very new, which later on would be known as people's warfare. And then terrorism tactics would be used, you see, under the claim that is the way the weak and the oppressed would fight against the powerful and the rich, you see. The terrorism is a form of struggle as any other form of struggle, which would be, of course, against completely Western values and civilization. So there, how did the Americans look at the situation at that time? With Diem becoming more and more repressive, and even cruel, literally, and bloody too, because he had to answer bloody methods by bloody methods,
Was he that much under the thumb of Washington? Did he have to say, okay, I would like to deal, if, for example, I would like to deal with this opposition in a different way? Would he have to place a phone call to the ambassador or to Washington,
D.C.? I wouldn't say that he was under the thumb of the Americans.
At that time?
I think Diem was the least under the thumb of the Americans if you compare to other so-called leaders of South Vietnam after him.
Okay.
First, because there was not much yet, intervention of the American
Right.
So that was not a very heavy, you know, and, restriction on him. He was not, you know, very dependent, although he was vitally dependent on the support and the beginning of aid that he received from the United States in order to set up that first republic in South Vietnam. But he had to do, you know, with you know, his own means, whatever he could in South Vietnam with the South Vietnamese population at that time. And it was only more and more with the American intervention that he depended more and more on the Americans, and you would say more and more under the thumb of Washington. But I think he put up a fight against Washington till the end.
How much of a role did his brother play? You've spoken to this.
Enormous, because it was the general impression of everybody that in the day-to-day, you know, the management of the regime, it was his brother, you see. Jim was much more, you know, in the principles and the ideals and so on, and he tried to project himself as an image of the nationalist Vietnam. But I think he failed completely to touch the majority of the Vietnamese people by the way that he was and his historical context.
Do you think he was a victim of this historical context? Was he a victim of this circumstance? Yeah.
I think we all are, you know. And then he made the best use of it with the best intentions in the world. He tried to project traditions and customs to the Vietnamese people, but from the imperial court as a Mandarin. And the United States were also very aware that he ruled as a Mandarin. And that was not the way, because the mindset of the people changed at that time already. And then he tried to, you know, infuse Western values to the Vietnamese in South Vietnam, and they were completely, you know, foreign. And so the question that we have to ask here, how the United States saw the problem of Vietnam at that time, and why, with the Diem regime as it was, it considered necessary to do what it did. And so there you are. I have the impression that the United States in the 50s, see, were already aware of a kind of a threat by international communism.
Absolutely.
And I think that the most critical point was when first Mao Zedong took power in 1949 in China. But you cannot say that communist China at that time was a threat to the United States. It was completely flat. You know, they were only able to chase a Chiang Kai-shek to Taiwan. That was all, you see, and try to organize themselves. But the most decisive element which came into play at that time was the USSR ability to explode the bomb. And so your nuclear superiority disappeared, more or less, you know, not completely. But there was some kind of an equilibrium, you know, coming up. So you are not, you know, in position to impose much of your will as in the past. And that was clear, you see. But I think the awareness of the United States of that threat, and it became so obvious with Red China, the People's Republic of China, and so on and so forth. I think it went back at the time of even Truman with Lyndon Johnson. He was very aware of that threat. So it would be an interesting to analyze that threat, you know. Was it valid, you know? And how was it that it, you know, brought the United States into Vietnam eventually? That threat, I think, was even more concrete with Eisenhower and Foster Dulles. And I think Foster Dulles was much more, you know, aware of that communist threat even more than Lyndon Johnson. He was very forceful later on.
Well, they saw Eisenhower and Dulles almost look at communism in religious terms. It was, you know, from the devil. It was, I mean, they were vehemently anti-communist, and combined in 1949 with the Soviet bomb, losing, quote-unquote, losing China, McCarthyism in the United States, this vehement anti-communist, it's almost as the United States did not have a choice. They were setting themselves up to defend, you know, communism or go against communism anywhere in the world. Do you feel like that's where our foreign policy was going? Do you feel like the United States really took missteps there in that vehement anti-communism?
Yeah, there are two aspects here. I think the awareness of a global threat of communism was very real at that moment. But I don't think that the United States thought that, you know, communist armies will, you know, rush to American territory and invade the United States. I don't think that they thought in that way. They thought in another context. That is to say, you may lose, you know, your ways of life. That is so-called freedom and democracy in the Western sense, and that you know, the spread of communism. But then, when you use the word the spread of communism, what kind of spread? I said it's not a, you know, military invasion of the United States. It is rather that you were against people becoming communists. You know, so people coming becoming communists, you have a contradiction in your own position. You cannot deny a guy to become a communist if he wants to be, because of your, you know, liberty of, you know, political views and expression and so on. But you were, I think, apprehensive that more and more people, you know, go the communist way in their thinking, you see, and you would object to that, you know. And then you say that if then all the other peoples in the world, you know, after the Second World War, more and more claimed to be communist as an ideal, you know, and I doubt very much that they were very much aware of what the kind of ideology that was, you know. But I think communism, you know, seemed to catch on as an aspiration to some sort of social justice, more freedom and liberty, less oppression by the rich and the powerful tycoons and things like that.
Right.
That's valid, you know. But it's not an invasion, you know, in the sense that we understand a military invasion of the United States. So was the United States really physically, materially, you know, threatened by military invasion by communist people? I don't think so. But you would not allow, you see, the thinking of the communist, you know, to destroy your ways of life. And it was also, I think, the general impression that the communists would not, you know, say no to very violent means of action. That is to say, they would resort to any means possible to obtain their political goals, including subversive activities, terrorism, you know, and all these things. And so, it was a thought at that time, I'm sure, from the time of Lynn Atkinson to Foster Dulles, that eventually those so-called communists, you know, would fight you by violence. And so you have to put a stop to that. You see? So that is on the on the one side, you know, the real threat, you know. And then on the other side, you cannot say deny the right of people to claim some kind of political affiliation. You see, that was the thing that the Vietnamese communists played on right away there in the 1950s, you know, when they claimed that they should have self-determination, you know, after the Geneva Accords in 1956 and so on, until the 1960s. You see, you can deny the right of the guy to self-determination, but then again, you see, I would call your attention What would that mean really in concrete terms to the Vietnamese people? Sure, they want to have independence and sovereignty in the end of colonial rule, but democracy would mean some determination, would merely mean that you, you know, just push the people to the polling stations and ask them to put a piece of paper in a ballot box. What does that mean to the overwhelming majority of the Vietnamese at that time? Was there any other way to allow the Vietnamese people to express, you know, their will? But to go to the polls, you say, would be a very Western practice.
Do you think they had the Vietnamese communists in the North had any better chance than the Western democratic thinkers to persuade the Vietnamese people to collect, rise up or to organize themselves and to take charge of their country?
Not in the name of communism, but they can motivate and mobilize those people in the name of the independence and sovereignty and so-called nationalism.
Okay.
Some sort that I'm sure that the overwhelming majority of the Vietnamese people had only vague ideas about those notions.
Mm-hmm. One thing the United States was really worried about was what Eisenhower termed publicly in 1954 was the domino theory, that if the United States allowed South Vietnam to become communist, if Ho Chi Minh ruled Vietnam, then Thailand, Laos, Cambodia would soon become fall to the communists and so forth, and it would spread to the West that way, eventually even threatening the Middle East. And then vice versa on the other side, if Vietnam fell, then the dominoes would fall eventually to the east, threatening Japan, threatening the defensive perimeter, etc. Do you think this domino theory was valid? Was it reasonable at the time in the 1950s in the United States to think that countries would fall to communism if one did?
That was a very fundamental, issue for the United States at that time. And people keep on saying whether the domino theory was valid or not.
Right.
You see, they failed completely to consider that issue, in its proper context. To say that you are against, the communization of those Southeast Asian countries, it's not completely false. That is to say, if they resort to violence and subversive acts, you are justified to put an end or to contain, as they said at that time, to the communization of the whole of the Indochinese Peninsula and the whole of Southeast Asia region.
Mm-hmm.
I think you can find justification to deal with that. But on the other hand, you have a contradiction in term too. If that process of communization, sprang from the people in those countries under the principle that they have the right to become communists or not, provided that they don't resort to violence, and terrorism, subversive acts, then you cannot, say you are against that political evolution. And so you mix there. You are mixed up there, You should have told the people very clearly, you have the right to be communist, but not to resort to violence, and subversive action to impose your communism on the people who may not be very much aware of the political values and issues and principles, And so what you have there to preserve is to preserve the ability of those people to have their say for the political future, But if you have to come in and you say that you are fighting against subversive actions, against aggressive actions, against violence, the people would not understand why they should not be allowed to choose any ideological affiliation that they wish. So that was the confusion, and you lose the battle strategically in the political sense with those people, the former colonies and so on and so forth. They would not understand. And the failure was there. Not that the domino theory was not valid, you know, in the sense that it may be just a political process and political evolution, not only in that area of the world, but everywhere else, mm-hmm. you see. So how can you try and show and convince the people that communism would eventually destroy their freedom and their sense of democracy? So that the problem of the domino theory, it was mm-hmm. not to say that it was true or not, that Vietnam, with the fall of Vietnam to the hands of Ho Chi Minh, would then be the communization of Laos, Cambodia, and then Malaysia, Indonesia, mm-hmm. the Philippines, and so on, you see. And so that was the unsettled point.
Were the intelligentsia, the people in Southeast Asia who were aware of such things, political currents in the world, were they aware of what you just said? Were they aware that, you know, the United States is saying the domino theory, but yet that doesn't make sense because they're all about self-determination, yet they're saying we shouldn't self-determine into a communist country? Were they aware of this contradiction that you spoke of?
They were not aware very much because they were not in position and have the intellectual capability to understand those things. It would, you know, take lots of research and study
right.
to be aware. But Ho Chi Minh, you know, was clever enough to jump on the opportunity
mm-hmm.
and said, here you are. You see, those guys, very rich and very powerful, they come here and they claim that they will bring you democracy and freedom. But look what happened in their own country. You know, it's all dominated by the tycoon, mm-hmm. you know, and political freedom would mean that how many millions of dollars you have in your pocket to go on the press, on TV, and you have your electoral campaigns. That's not the kind of, you know, liberty and freedom and democracy that you have here in this poor country of Vietnam. Mm-hmm. So that was very easy, you know, for Ho Chi Minh and his group to project that image. Very much educated, you know, the overwhelming majority of the Vietnamese in Vietnam, to say that the kind of freedom and democracy, that is a form of neo-imperialism. That is the continuation of another form of colonial rule,
okay.
you see. And not because was able, Ho Chi Minh was able to describe very effectively, you know, that thing, but because the Vietnamese people didn't know anything else.
Are you saying that the United States was almost condemned from the very beginning? They had very little chance in Vietnam from the very beginning.
It's not condemned very little thing, but you went in with such, you know, enormous handicaps.
Right.
You see? And compare that it is here, the political balance of forces.
Uh-huh.
You know, you came in with such great handicaps. You know, in spite of all the military mind, which would not change anything in the specific political, you know, setup.
Mm-hmm. We touched briefly earlier, sir, on China and Chinese intentions in Vietnam. And one thing that dominated American policy and American thinking was the fear that China would intervene militarily directly in Vietnam at some point if the United States took too many actions militarily. What are your feelings on Chinese intentions toward Vietnam in this time?
I think, again, you have to put it in its historical context.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when Mao Zedong was able to take power in China in 1949,
mm-hmm.
it was not a military power.
Mm-hmm.
It was not much of a threat to the security of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was some vague idea that they belonged to the communist group, and that they allied of the Soviet Union,
mm-hmm.
Which then began to have a bomb, you see. And then, of course, for Ho Chi Minh, you know, Mao Zedong would be an ally because they have the same ideology of communism.
Mm-hmm.
But to say that the People's Republic of China was a threat to the United States, I don't think so. But it was considered that they may give a very helping hand to Hanoi.
Mm-hmm.
You see? And secondly, I think the historical context here, and you were profoundly affected by it, that was the Korean War.
Yes.
You know, how was it possible for China, you know, completely almost destitute, you know, was able to fight in the Korean War? And as always, Mao Zedong will rely on the numbers, you know. Mm-hmm. He will send his millions of people, even in with bare hands, you know, to there. And again, it's not a matter of military might. You see, they play on a very sensitive nerve. That is your, you know, civilized Christian values that, you know, just kill me, you know, millions. Of almost, you know, destitute without even a rifle. And you knew that many of them had wooden rifles in Korea, you know, because they didn't have real rifles, you see. But would your Christian values allow you to continue and kill and kill and kill, you see? That is also the parallel later on with Hanoi. You bomb them, as I said, you bomb them to the Stone Age. They just sit you out, that's all. You see? Mm-hmm. And so, was it a real threat? And I think that even at the time of Kennedy, not to mention Johnson and Nixon later on, they were very apprehensive about the possible participation of Chinese ground forces. Mm-hmm. It either you escalate a little bit too much. Mm-hmm. But repeatedly, you see, Beijing has made it clear that it would not send ground troops into North Vietnam or into Vietnam if, you know, no foreign troops cross the border.
Into North Vietnam?
Into China.
Into China.
Yeah. Okay. It was very clear, you see. But people could not believe the Chinese entirely. And then you have to see the context too, that there was a rivalry ideologically between Mao Zedong and Stalin, you know, not to mention Lenin even before, that they had the pure you know, communist thinking ideology, you know. But then there were two different cases completely, you know. The Marxist-Leninist doctrine is sprang out of an industrial, you know, background. Mm-hmm. Why the Chinese were completely agricultural. Mm-hmm. And that's why Mao tried to infuse, you know, his own personal interpretation of Marxism, you see, using the idea of the rural areas with besiege the citadels and so on and overcome, you see, those things. So there was that rivalry. And also, traditionally, you know, Russia has always been a threat to China, you see. And so they have to remember that. And it was very real, that, you know, confrontation between the Soviet Union and the Chinese. And so at one point, as you know, you have a million troops, you know, looking at each other at the borders. And then I think that Ho Chi Minh did not have any choice, really, you know. With 1,000 years of Chinese domination and so on, before you know, being a communist or not communist, you have to think that your country may be over, maybe rule again under some form of Chinese influence. Mm-hmm. And so the best thing for him is to reach out to the Soviet Union to placate the Chinese threat, because it was a threat, has always been a threat. You know, when you're such a small guy, we are besides a very big neighbor, you see. And so, how real was the conflict between the Soviet Union and China, you see, and China at that time? I think that it was not a matter of territorial ambition, you see. It was much more ideological and political, you see. Mao wouldn't accept the kind of, you know, interpretation from the Marxist-Leninist doctrine you know, in his political system. And the Soviet Union, I think we must say, they had international you know, aspirations, you know. Not to send their armies, you know, to other countries, but they would like very much that, you know, other countries in the world you know, give allegiance to the Soviet Union. That was very clear. That was very clear. And so, North Vietnam was the opportunity for the Soviet Union to use the pincer principle on China. And then automatically, China had to retaliate. Mm-hmm. So they must try to have a hold on Vietnam somehow. Mm-hmm. You know. If not in the north, maybe in the south. See? And of course, you have the problem of Laos and Cambodia. Mm-hmm. Laos, Cambodia have been put together with Vietnam under the French, under China. But Laos and Vietnam, in the sense that it was used by the Chinese, you know, to neutralize, you know, as much as possible the pincer part, you know, played by North Vietnam with the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. That explained also the Khmer Rouge, mm-hmm. which would have existed without Beijing. Mm-hmm. And without Beijing, they disappear, mm-hmm. you know, very fast. And I would say that it was an unavowed policy of Beijing to have a hold of Vietnam. I'm sure, to relieve the pressure of the Soviet Union. And that is very logical, you see. And Beijing did try with the NLF inside Vietnam. Because they thought at one time that the NLF could be autonomous, you know, completely under the Hanoi hold. You see. And of course they did not understand very well either, like the Americans, what the LNF was. You see. The LNF came into being, maybe spontaneously, from a number of people who were against the Diem repressive regime. But the LNF would not have survived, as many people would claim that the Saigon government would not have survived without American aid, mm-hmm. and so the LNF would not be anything without Hanoi aid.
That's a really controversial thing in American scholarship and about the Vietnam Wars.
Yes.
Was what happened in South Vietnam truly an organic insurgency springing from the people of South Vietnam, or was it always orchestrated from Hanoi?
The question there can be answered very easily. You know? Mm-hmm. Would Hanoi permit a South Vietnam mm-hmm. otherwise than a communist, mm-hmm. you know,
yes.
Political system? And so history has shown that anywhere in the world, it's very hard for a communist, you know, the system to permit other political, you know, systems to coexist.
Right.
You see? And so, why not ask yourself the same question? With the Soviet Union, would it be possible that Czechoslovakia, Poland, the Bulgaria, and Hungary, mm-hmm. To be a kind of a South Vietnam? It's aberrant, you know, it's an aberration to ask such a question, that South Vietnam could exist, you know, parallel, you know, and not being communist with North Vietnam. Mm-hmm. If that happened, it would be just, you know, a chess move, mm-hmm. you know, temporarily.
So you're saying
because the whole thing exists, whether, you know, that question would be valid or not, is in the balance of forces. Would South Vietnam one day, if it disagrees, would North Vietnam be in position to defend itself? It's not a matter whether, you know, you have a true nationalism in South Vietnam or whether you have just camouflaged communism in South Vietnam for some time, mm-hmm. but whether South Vietnam would be in position to defend itself. Mm-hmm. If one day, you know, Hanoi said, that, well, I have enough of that, you know, the game is finished. That was the question.
Okay.
And so that was also the question of the non-communist Vietnamese. Mm-hmm. Would they be in position to put up a fight, you know, with the Soviet Union and the People in the Republic of China behind Hanoi? Would they be in position to fight? Hopeless. They have to call in somebody. You see? Mm-hmm. But then, you know, Ho Chi Minh was cleverer than Diem and all the rest. Mm-hmm. They didn't call in Soviet troops. They didn't call in Chinese troops.
Right.
And maintain their political advantage.
That would have been doing the same thing,
yes,
as right. calling in the Americans.
Yes,
do you think the Americans missed an opportunity with the Chinese, maybe to play the Chinese off of Hanoi?
Well, they misread Beijing completely from the beginning, even in Korea.
Okay.
See? And then, would they trust the Chinese in such a thing? And then, the next step is that when there was nothing left, you know, would it be better, you know, for them to give it to the Chinese? They gave the Spratly Islands to Chinese, didn't do against that. That is to guard Cameron Bay. Eventually, it would have become Russian anyway. You see,
right?
So you can shell, you know, like the PRC, you know, shell Matsui and Kemoi, you know, out of offshore Taiwan. Mm-hmm. You know, the Chinese from the Spratly Islands could have shelled Cameron Bay, you know, 20,000 rounds a day,
right.
And no Russian ship would be able to go in and out.
Right.
See, so that's the thing. And then you will eventually see the evolution of things more and more indicated. The ambitions of Beijing in Vietnam, and particularly in South Vietnam.
Do you think the Vietnamese people, during this very crucial time period, in the late 50s, early 60s, do you think they know what they want it to be? Did they realize the historical context in which they were caught?
I doubt very much. They have been, you know, so long under colonial rule, and then went through the hectic times of the Second World War with the Japanese, and then all those so-called Allied troops coming back, and so on and so forth. I think the very first and main concern, as anybody else, is to be left alone to begin with. And to be left alone is already the beginning of freedom and democracy, to be left alone. And whoever, I think in my opinion, you know, went against that and claimed ideological motivations and reasons to perpetrate a war there, in whatever name, you see, would go against that feeling of independence, sovereignty, democracy, and freedom of the Vietnamese people. And so nobody was really justified and can honestly claim that you were for your ideals and deprive the Vietnamese people over 20 years of being left alone.
Sir, could you talk a little bit about what happened in August 1964 and the aftermath of that in Vietnam, the Gulf of Tonkin incident, or incidents?
Well, I think first of all, again, we have to put it in its historical context.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1964, I think the situation was degenerating very fast.
Mm-hmm.
That is after the overthrow of President Diem in 1963. You had a chaotic situation in Saigon. And I think that there was a sincere desire by President Johnson to see a democratic form of government in South Vietnam. And in spite of the escalation of the subversive action and beginning of really almost conventional warfare, launched by Hanoi on South Vietnam since 1960. Then you had a succession of all so-called civilian governments in the Saigon. And at that time, the question was not whether Washington had a choice, you know, in that kind of a war, but to escalate. And I'm still convinced that the escalation was initiated and started with the action by Hanoi, which they may claim it is to defend democracy and freedom and self-determination in South Vietnam against Diem and then Diem's successors. And I think it's fair enough to say that the stability of the Saigon government or the Saigon political regime in opposition to Hanoi was in a very bad situation, critical. And so here is a very interesting question for Washington at that time. Would it let, you know, South Vietnam go its own way?
Right.
With a very disturbing question in the back, would it be, you know, taken over, overcome by Ho Chi Minh from North Vietnam? So the situation there was a dilemma, I think, for Washington. On one hand, it had to contain the subversive and what we should say violent means of action perpetrated by Hanoi, and at the same time give the South Vietnamese, you know, an opportunity or chance to have their own say, whether they would like to continue with the kind of anti-communism instituted by Ngô Đình Diệm, or they would like to have a kind of a compromise with their brother enemies. That was the right of the Vietnamese in South Vietnam. That right was denied to them by both Hanoi and Washington.
How would they have done that? Through referendum?
As usual, that is to say, some kind of a coup in Saigon on the more liberal faction, maybe the Caravelle group, or maybe the NLF, if it were really, truly South Vietnamese. then to try and have real, genuine representative government. And here, in inverted commas, in function of the capability of the Vietnamese in South Vietnam to appreciate democracy and freedom in the sense that the West would understand it, why Ho Chi Minh and his group didn't try to argue that popular democracy, direct from the grassroots, under a communist system, would be better for a country coming out of colonial rule and now have to face what they call the neo-imperialism.
Okay.
So that was too sophisticated for the Vietnamese in South Vietnam to understand. And again, I think that they would be quite happy if they were left alone by everybody to begin with.
Are you talking about it was too difficult for the ordinary South Vietnamese population or the intelligentsia?
Yes. Well, the intelligentsia would be much in better position to appreciate that, and it is also their duty to make the ordinary people understand the issues involved and the dilemma in which they were. And they had to make a choice. I mean, if they have no other choice than to go communist, then they had to go communist, you see. But if they had an opportunity not to be communist and have something, you know, not communist, and I would then explain to them why, you see. So the real issue at that time was for President Johnson, first of all, to placate the subversive action and the warlike and the war activities of Hanoi against South Vietnam in the name of democracy, freedom, you know, communist way, and also under the claim of a self-determination. You see? And then it would be an aberration, you see, to accept the view of the Hanoi leaders at that time that they were, you know, prepared as they were in the 1940s, in the 1950s, you see, by that time, 1964, that they were prepared to have some kind of compromise, a coalition, you know, even almost a neutral, you know, South Vietnam regime, political regime, you see. So why didn't they say that for the whole of Vietnam? And then here you come back to the 1954 Geneva Accords.
Right.
They were happy to have the partition of Vietnam at the 17th parallel. And they claimed that they were too Vietnam in order to preserve what they claim to have, the sovereignty and independence of North Vietnam. See? But they would not grant that same privilege to the South Vietnamese. See? And they would play only on, you know, their ships. But they wouldn't put their ships on the table. Mm-hmm. So if they were sincere in themselves, they say, yeah, let's go in, you know, the international control and supervision and observers, and let's give the whole Vietnamese nation, the Vietnamese nation, a chance to have a say. Okay? Not just the South Vietnamese. Mm-hmm. And so you went into the game with your handicap there. But then even with the handicap, and with the limitation, the restriction, and with the apprehension that the Chinese may move in, you know, with their crammed troops, and then you also have to take into consideration at that time the nuclear umbrella of the Soviet Union, mm-hmm. Then President Johnson must do something. Mm-hmm. And that incident, the Tonkin incident, whether it's true or not, is almost immaterial, because President Johnson had the need to intervene and make Hanoi understand that I'm serious about this business, you know. And in the end, now it turned out that the Hanoi people claim that from the central government they never gave the order, you know, to attack the Thermotroya Maddox and so on and so forth. It was a local decision.
Okay.
Maybe a local decision. Doesn't matter really. But it was a necessity for President Johnson at that time to act. But to act, you know, forcefully. And also there was a message to, that he wanted to send to the Soviet Union and to China.
Right.
You know, I have no ambition to take over North Vietnam. So, let us have appeasement, containment, and coexistence. That was, you know, the fashion at that time. Mm-hmm. But I'm going to defend South Vietnam. And according to domestic political practices in the United States, you see, I must act. And the Tonkin incident was good enough for President Johnson to act.
And by this time, you think it was perhaps way too late for any kind of elections or any kind of popular referendum in 1963-64?
The UN, because of the political strategy that you limit yourself in there. Mm-hmm. You see, you were not the one to call the shots. You just respond. You know, you simply the Washington simply responded to the initiative taken by Hanoi, mm-hmm. And that's what the Pentagon generals kept on saying since the 50s, the late 50s, that the UN went into a game. And at the conditions dictated by that vessel, you didn't have initiative, you responded only. And their purpose was to call, to draw you into that, mm-hmm. You see? Not to get you out, you know? But to draw you in more and more for political reasons. That was much more important for them to increase the American intervention and the American presence. Because their toughest job is to convince the Vietnamese people that they were right, you see? And they couldn't do that without the American presence. You see? No. And Ho Chi Minh was very aware of that. All the, and the Resolution 15, you know, show you very well the trap that they set for you. You see? It's not what they wanted to do by themselves, but what they wanted to do with you, the Americans.
They were willing to make that sacrifice in people, number one.
That was a form of fighting.
Oh, yeah.
You see? And so, instead of having B-52s and, you know, bombs and things like that, that was the way for them to fight.
And they were willing to make the sacrifice, knowing that if the United States came in and established a military, strong military presence in South Vietnam, that eventually there would be fighting and there would be, you know, millions.
And that's
killed.
Another strategic aspect. Mm-hmm. In that Vietnam War, you know, as far as Washington was concerned, mm-hmm. when Hanoi, Ho Chi Minh and his troops said that they were willing to make all the sacrifices, they knew very well that the sacrifices they made were extreme, mm-hmm. you see. But the suffering and the pain to them was much less than the pain and the suffering that the American would, run into eventually. Right? So they were flat completely, you know. And so whatever you may do to them, they have reached their maximum level of sufferings and pain. You cannot do more. But you will feel more and more pain and suffering in the years to come if you continue. And I want you to come in, you know, more, so that you can suffer more. And you will find out what they would see, the realities of things. The political realities, not the military realities.
Why do you think the United States misread that, couldn't understand that?
Because, you see, your military came up with something very new. You asked, you know, the military to carry out a war. And as Joshua said, you know, a war is too serious a thing to leave it entirely in the hands of the military. Mm-hmm. And because Sensei and Clausewitz taught you centuries ago that the war is just a political arm of your political aims. Mm-hmm. And so that was it. You responded in conventional ways to something very new. That is to say, casualties, you know, that the Hanoi tried to inflict on the American people, not the American government, on the American people, were not the body counts. You jumped into the body counts. But for them, it was, you know, a sensitive nerve that they can play on the, you know, Western democracy, on your Christian values, and on your civilized ways of life. They would demonstrate that with the enormous might of the United Nations, you would inflict, you know, pains and suffering to a tiny nation and people. So that was the trick. They would win in the end, unless you adapt yourself to their type of fighting, which is now even truer than 40 years ago. Mm-hmm.
If the United States had adopted that type of fighting from the beginning, do you think there would have been a different outcome?
Yes, and have the courage also to accept the possible colonization of San Vietnam, if that were the choice of the Vietnamese people. Mm-hmm. And if, you know, people always say, you know, you deserve the kind of government you have.
In 1965, at age 29, you became Minister of Labor in the Saigon government. Can you discuss how that came about?
Well, that was very unexpected. I didn't have anything to do with politics or with the political regime in Saigon. Mm-hmm. I was completely absorbed with my job in the private sector, mm-hmm. and with the most powerful and biggest oil company in the world. Mm-hmm. And because at that time it was Esso Standard Eastern. Used to be Stanbeck, a joint venture between Standard Oil New Jersey and Mobil. Mm-hmm. But then out of the draw from the hat, Vietnam and Cambodia went to the Esso. So I still don't know how and why, you know, I was called to that job. The only thing that I could, you know, make out that probably the success that I had with the workers' union of the petroleum industry in negotiating for 2 years, mm-hmm. very tough negotiation. Mm-hmm. It was the very first time mm-hmm. that in South Vietnam you had any dealings directly with the workers' union. And the workers' union at that time were considered, you know, heavily infiltrated by Viet Cong or anti-government people. Mm-hmm. And I was able to negotiate and get agreement mm-hmm. with the Petroleum Workers' Union for the first collective industry collective agreement of Vietnam. It was used right away as a model for the plantation workers, rubber plantation workers, and for the banks, and so on. Mm-hmm. And very unexpectedly, I was going to become labor minister, even at the age of 29, without any knowledge of government affairs or experience of any sort.
you write in your book that you were basically approached and said, show up at this meeting, or, and as you wrote in the book, or you will have to go into military service.
Yeah, to be drafted, because I was at the age to be drafted, and I belonged to the group which would have to go to the Kuduk Reserve Officers Training Academy, you know, but that was the name to differentiate it from the professional soldiers, and only young adults at the drafting age must go through. And thanks to ESSO, because we claimed that we were also involved in the military support activities, and my father knew lots of the high-ranking officials in the Saigon government, I was granted deferment. But then by 1965, after the overthrow of President Diem, the chaotic situation and so on, and the military took over power with the Army Council at the beginning of 65 with the bloodless coup to push aside Jeannine Khan and so on. And then the army took over from Prime Minister Phan Huy Quát. That time, still, the American effort to have the civilian government, and that was it. I joined the government, which was at that time called the Executive Central Committee of the Army Council, and Jean Key was made the chairman of that executive committee. And Jeannine Thieu was the chairman of the National Leadership Committee, which temporarily replaced the legislative branch, because we didn't have anything. But then President Johnson was very eager to get the democracy on tracks again, and he insisted very much that, very fast we should have a constitution, a new one, and then the general elections, and elect your president, and so on and so forth, so, to be democratic. So, in a way, you can say that I joined the Ministry of Labor, but as a member of the Army Council, because that was military rule completely at that time.
What did you think of this job? I mean, were you?
I didn't have any idea whatsoever, except for the labor matters, of course.
Right.
And I was familiar with the workers' unions and with the officials of the labor ministry. And, since the time of President Diem, they have set up the confederation of the workers' unions of Vietnam, and that was Mr. Trong Quoc Bo, who was the head of it, and he worked very intimately with the special advisor, political advisor Ngo Đình Nhu, to control the workers' movement. And the U.S. embassy, landed a hand to try and help that the workers' movement. Basically, its affiliation was to the Christian Workers' Union, the International Federation of Christian Workers' Unions, IFCTU. So that was the imprint of President Diem, very Christian, which was predominantly Catholic, of course. And so that was the setup I had to deal with.
What were your major duties?
Well, the first duty that I was given by the Army Council, that is the Executive Committee, was to maintain industrial peace. And then the second duty would be somehow to improve the workers' condition, you see. And the third was some kind of a welfare policy to help a lot of the workers. It was daily. I was not given any particular job, and Jeannine Khi, who became Prime Minister, did not have any idea how those ministries are operated, and he was so busy with his generals and with the war and with the Americans that most of the ministries, except the Ministry of Defense, of course, were left to those so-called ministers.
So you had relative autonomy. You
could completely, almost completely. There was no restriction, there was no directives, there was nothing at all. And for me at the Labour Ministry, there was no means at all of action. And the answer was a tiny ministry and a tiny budget.
Right. Yeah. You were the youngest? Were you the youngest?
Yes, the very youngest. And that was the first time, I think, that they had anybody in their 20s to be a minister. And I remember there was some kind of an article somewhere in the national press that at that moment there were only two guys in the world who were in their 20s and were with the cabinet ministers. That was me in Vietnam and Bouteflika in Algeria.
Wow. How much did you get paid for this job, do you remember?
Oh, well, we should have, decent pay. But in order to project an image of the new government, the Army Council and Prime Minister Key put out the policy of national austerity. That is, we have to be economical and so on. Mm-hmm. And so our ministerial pay was in about 20-something thousand dongs at that time. That was even less than what I paid my, private secretary.
You got paid 200,000 dong a month by ESSO.
Oh, yeah.
About, and then now you go down to
23,000, I think, if I remember correctly. Wow. But then in order to camouflage that, there was also a black fund equivalent to 2 months' salary of the minister that you can draw on as you need, kind of an overdraft, as you say,
right.
but you don't have to submit receipts. And so my secretary just used it to buy, cigarettes and sandwiches and things like that,
right.
And we don't have, and it was not even enough for those things.
Gosh.
Yeah.
So very.
But I suppose that in other ministries, they have more means, of course, they can manipulate their budget and funds to cover lots of things. But the Minister of Labour was really, the poor cousin in the whole lot.
You were in that job for how long?
About a year.
What was the most rewarding thing about that position?
Well, the greatest trauma that they had with me at the Labour Ministry was the general strike. All of us, South Vietnam, that was the very first, because Ngo Dinh Diem wouldn't have allowed, any kind of strike, because mm-hmm. everybody was behind him and mm-hmm. supporting him and his regime.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was the general, the attitude of everybody that the Vietnamese Confederation of Workers was just a government, instrument and tool, and nobody believed in it. And so I was distraught by that, because I really, respected the workers' union,
mm-hmm.
The ideal of the mm-hmm. workers' union. And many of the employers in Saigon at that time refused to deal with the workers' union, reluctantly only they deal. I came out openly. I said that it's a plus to have the workers organized. Mm-hmm. I was completely against the closed shop. And I discussed for weeks with the workers' union who wanted to have the closed shop, because many of them have a closed shop. That is, say, any employee coming into a company must join the workers' union. I said, no. You have to give them the possibility to be or not to be mm-hmm. member of the workers' union, you see. And besides, I said that I'm against also using company time for mm-hmm. The union affairs. You can have that after, office work.
Okay.
I can provide you the premises, but I would not take the company time for union activities. That is your own affair. And the workers' union accepted that position. I mean, they try, of course, but to defend their interest. Mm-hmm. But in the end, it was fair enough. Or I said that, like the other employers, you would not have any recognition of the workers' union at all. See, I recognize you, and I would not, be prepare or inclined to have other workers' union, organized, but mm-hmm. I recognize your workers' union mm-hmm. in my company. And so that was a plus. And so when I was in when I took over the labor ministry, I was really unhappy to see the kind of artificial way to deal with the workers' union, because I really believe that the workers' union by themselves was also a substantial force, and even politically, in your fight for political aims. But of course, in principle, the workers' union should be outside the political thing. But you cannot, because as I said earlier, the absence of any meaningful, effective political parties in South Vietnam, or any organized movement in the mass of the people. So you end up, first of all, with the religious group. And the religious group there, you would have the Buddhists to begin with. And then you have the Wahao, the Cao Dai religious sects. And the second group that would be of any meaning, to have a political impact, would be the students. You see, the General Federation of the Students, and so they are also a kind of the intelligentsia, you see. And then, of course, you have the workers' unions as organized mass, you see. And I kept on saying, to the generals that in the absence of, any political, meaningful political organizations in South Vietnam, you already have, two largest political parties in South Vietnam that you mistreated most, They were the most handicapped, That's the civil servants and the soldiers, you see. They were the two pillars of the regime. They were, the worst paid, And nobody paid attention to them. They were organized, and they stood together, you see, and until the end, they missed the point. But Jim did see the point, but then he did it in the wrong way. He organized them under his Catholicism, and his own views, instead of allowing those troops to express themselves meaningfully and genuinely, to become a force.
What kind of relationship did you have with General Key, General Thu, with the generals?
That's very funny, because General Key was my prime minister. But I can tell you the whole period that I was involved with the Saigon government, he had never made a phone call to me. We only met in cabinet meetings and in social events and so on. On the other hand, General Thieu, who was out of power, he was the chairman of the leadership committee, and he sat at the general headquarters of the Arvin. Then he called me very often and exchanged views and talk and things like that. And then eventually I moved to other ministerial posts, to cabinet posts, but in 1967, after days of disputes and quarrels, General Key finally accepted to be vice president in the ticket with him. And I was then given the job to be kind of a national chairman for the election of that ticket. Another contradiction in terms, you see. So I put up the mechanical, procedures to get those elections through. And then, after General Thieu became president, he called me very often and, to discuss matters. And, of course, people thought that I was a man of General Key. But I think that General Thieu also discovered very soon that I was nobody's, you know. And I always set, you know, my mind very straight. Disagree or I agree, I just said it, you know, because I didn't belong to any political parties. I was not interested in any, you know, things in particular. And that was, I think, the general impression, even with the so-called political parties in Saigon, because together with the constitution and the general elections, it was also necessary for President Johnson to see, you know, very democratic laws and so on. And it was a real headache for the Saigon government how to encourage political parties, you know, to play their roles in the thing, provided they have allegiance to the Saigon regime. And then they put out the political parties' legislation, how you were allowed to set up a political party, how you should, and during the cabinet meeting, when they passed that law, I was always the youngest in the cabinet, and also the very last that people, you know, bother to ask for my views.
Right.
And I also gave very sharp replies. I said that the Vietnamese in South Vietnam never had any, you know, knowledge or habits or their practice to have political parties. That would be very new to them. And now you have hundreds of political parties, you know, in Saigon. But if you go to the suburb of Saigon, I said in Phu Lam, that was just outside of Saigon, and the people there would know, you know, any political party or political leaders at all. It was same to them, and so the so-called political parties didn't like me very much. So nobody approached me to join their party or say anything. I was left alone.
Was that what your most frustrating thing about the job is, that you really didn't have a lot of input, or that
I didn't have what?
A lot of input. What was the most frustrating thing about that job for you?
Frustrating,
difficult.
Well, it's not that I was really frustrated, because I didn't expect much. The things were too big, even for the Saigon government to, you know, respond to the subversive and war activities launched by communists, because we know they were launched by the communists. And the, what I tried to do within the sphere of action from the labor ministry was kind of, if you say frustrated, it was a frustration like a storm in a teacup. You know, so so most encouraged and permitted the general strike to happen to give some, you know, meaning and dignity back to the workers.
Right.
And that was what I think was most rewarding for me during my stay at the Labour Ministry. That horrified everybody, of course. And maybe that was the reason. On the one hand, I think the U.S. Embassy with John Condon, who was there as the labor attaché, eventually understood that, instead of setting up a bogus workers' movement for your anti-communist crusade. And on the other hand, probably the Saigon politicians would jump on the occasion and say that, you know, that little guy at the labor ministry is doing, you know, lots of bad things and so on. But I think I demonstrated that I was able to be objective enough not to take sides, and that's probably why I was kicked upstairs to the Prime Minister's office.
How much interaction did you have with the Americans there at the Ministry of Labor?
Very good. Yeah. That was the time when Philippe Habib came as a political counselor there, and I had a very good labor attaché as my advisor. That was John Condon. You know, eventually he became U.S. ambassador too. But Philippe Habib was really good. Was really good. And the man was able to appreciate the problems there. But again, You see, he was in a position that he would be able to do so much.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Mm-hmm. I think he was overwhelmed by, first of all, Maxwell Taylor. So had his own views about the whole thing,
right?
And then afterwards you have Cabot Lodge,
right?
You know, back there once again, and we were very particularly with the Henry Cabot Lodge. He took me in right away, almost as a son, and because his son George Lodge,
mm-hmm.
I think, was Under Secretary of Labor at that mm-hmm. time in the United States. And he was very much, he missed very much his son.
Mm-hmm.
And he would like to have his son visit him in Saigon and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And through the discussion said, I need to have a visit by Mr. George Lodge from the Labor Department of the United States to help me. At my labor ministry, particularly with the statistics, because I had the row with the economy minister at that time.
Mm-hmm.
He was presenting, his economic development program in the cabinet meeting, and when he came to me again at the end to give my views on the economic development, there's no economic development in time of war. You can hardly have the means to feed the people, and if you don't have enough rice, then the U.S. will give you the rice to feed the people, and that's it, you see. And he presented his development in various sectors, in the industry, the uh-huh. agriculture. I said to him very briefly, how do you, how did you do your planning, your projection, your mm-hmm. economic projection? So he gave me all kinds of statistics. I said, I don't know about your statistics, but I'm sure you need manpower statistics too.
Mm-hmm.
I, at the labor ministry, I don't have any. And if I had any, the next day would be completely false, because a few bombs will scatter all my carpenters and masons and mechanics everywhere. That's what I responded to his economic development program for South Vietnam. So I jumped on that occasion to say to the Ambassador Lodge that I need to have his son here to give me a hand to understand the situation. And he came.
Mm-hmm.
George Lodge paid a visit to Saigon at the great delight of Ambassador Lodge, his father.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about, just briefly, Maxwell Taylor. What was your relationship with Ambassador Taylor?
I didn't have any relationship with him because he was the preceding mm-hmm. period. And he was much more involved with General Cannon at that time.
He left in July 65, and that's before you...
That's it.
Okay.
That is just a month after I joined the government.
Okay.
And then Ambassador Lodge came back.
Okay. And how about Ambassador
Lodge? But the general impression that we had of General Ambassador Maxwell Taylor he was really a general, much more than an ambassador. And the Saigon generals really suffered, during his stay there, because he considered them almost as West Point cadets. And he didn't hide that, and it was known in the international press that he called them like cadets. Publicly.
Really?
Yeah.
And that did not go over well, I'm sure.
Well, the Saigon generals, I'm sure, needed that. but you can do it in different ways.
Yeah.
He was really frustrated.
Was very frustrated. How about Henry Cabot Lodge? Tell me about him.
Oh, he was a very knowledgeable man.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, fiercely anti-communist.
Mm-hmm.
And probably the... effect of his stay at the United Nations, to deal with Stalin and Molotov and all these people. And he was, a great old man, with lots of experience and so on and so forth. But again, you see, he was very much also under the lines taken by Washington. And I think that in Washington, people really try hard. I'm sure that they must have had lots of brainstorming sessions
mm-hmm.
to find out the answers to the problems. But I think Ambassador Lodge was sincerely convinced that the Saigon people could have made it if you helped them properly. I think he believed in it. Mm-hmm. There was no reason for him not to believe in it. And probably he hoped very strongly that the Saigon regime after Diem and the chaotic situation of the so-called civilian governments, mm-hmm. now, you know, the military would give some degree of stability, and then if you can beef up the social and economic, you know, aspects of the situation, mm-hmm. he probably sincerely thought that the Saigon regime would have more and more popular support. But of course, nobody bothered to analyze deeper in details mm-hmm. what popular support would mean. So that was the flaw.
How much contact did you have with him?
Was it a lot. He insists very much that he would join me in the social events, because after that I went to the welfare ministry.
Right.
And so at the beginning there was also Mrs. Lodge. And I was much closer to Mrs. Lodge, mm-hmm. because I was invited for dinner and lunch at their private residence mm-hmm. very often. Mm-hmm. And they always join me in those social events when there was something going on. And later on, they were again in Paris for the Paris Peace Talks.
Right.
And we were very happy to meet again there. And there was also a small incident that while I was at the welfare ministry, there mm-hmm. was a very nice young American lady there. Mm-hmm. And we called her Pooh.
Pooh?
Yes.
Okay.
And Mrs. Lodge always called her Pooh, so I called her Pooh too. And we went on very well during Saigon, because I was still a bachelor at that time, mm-hmm. and whenever there was a possibility to meet and to mix with other groups and so on, and Pooh was there, and we went on very well. Mm-hmm. And then when in 68 I went to Paris, she also stopped her welfare work in Saigon and moved to Paris and took a very nice house just behind my house,
okay.
in the Neuilly area. Mm-hmm. And Mrs. Lutz was at Fung, why don't you marry Pooh, you know? And it went on for some time there, but we were just good friends. Mm-hmm. And that was it. So probably I missed the opportunity to live in Boston.
Have you had any contact with Pooh since Paris?
No. So afterwards it was too hectic, and she left Paris when I got married in Paris.
Right.
Okay.
Okay, so we'll wrap for the day.
All right.
This is Richard Verone. We are continuing the interview session with Ambassador Fong. It is Friday, October 4th. We're back in the interview room, the Special Collections Library, Texas Tech University, and it's approximately 9:30 in the morning. Lester Fong, we've been discussing this crucial time period in not only Vietnamese history, but world history, and American history, and basically the period from 1950, 54 to 65. 65, you have the direct escalation of the American conflict with bringing over thousands and thousands of troops in a real military commitment, overt military commitment to South Vietnam. But before that happens, you go from a private businessman working for ESSO to being thrust into government service in 1965. And then in 1966, a year later, you are kicked up, as you said, into the Prime Minister's office as a minister. You're right there on the ground, involved in this government, helping make decisions that will shape the future of Vietnam. And that's where I want to start the question this morning is, how did you feel, and what do you think you could do to shape the course of where this conflict was going? there was obviously at this point a conflict. There was the North Vietnamese, the South Vietnamese, the Americans were very interested in sustaining South Vietnam as a quote-unquote outpost of the free world. There were millions of dollars in financial aid coming in, military aid coming in, and you're right there at the epicenter. So how do you feel at this point in 1965-66? And if we want to go there in just a minute, leading up to that point in Vietnamese history, in this decade of maybe this was a giant missed opportunity here for things to maybe shift or change between 55 and 65. What are your feelings on this?
Well, I think I continue to believe very strongly that the 1950s, especially after the Geneva Accord of 1954, and then coming to 1960, that was the time I returned to Saigon from England.
Yes.
Well, I did not feel any, situation of war, really.
Mm-hmm.
People were able to circulate day and night, you know. And then there was not much fighting yet, you know, at the beginning of 1960. Although, at that particular point in time, many things happened. But I think that those things happened even without much awareness on the part of the Vietnamese, both I'm sure in North Vietnam and in South Vietnam, that it was the creation of the National Liberation Front in opposition to what was considered to be a repressive regime of President Ngo Đình Diem. In the North, I'm sure that Ho Chi Minh and the government of the DRV did try to explain to the people in North Vietnam that there was the 1954 Geneva Accord, which provided for the partition of the military forces, both sides, mainly on one side the French forces, the other side the so-called Viet Minh forces at that time.
Mm-hmm.
But in the North, they would have understood much better that 1954 Geneva Accord, which provided for eventual general elections, and under the claim that the Vietnamese people would then have self-determination and decide what kind of political regime they would like to have. And I'm sure that Ho Chi Minh and his government in North Vietnam were, you know, dead sure to win those general elections. So the 1954 Geneva Accords were not recognized by the United States.
Right.
But then somehow, you know, it was a kind of a contradiction that for the South Vietnamese, you know, who I'm sure did not like to have the country divided, you know. But then it was a way for them to have the hope that the killing would stop and that the war would stop. That would be considered as the Second Indochina War against
mm-hmm.
the French
mm-hmm.
And so on. And so they seem to claim de facto, if it's not de jure, you see, the existence of two Vietnams.
Right.
That is very interesting. You see, whether they keep on having that idea of dividing. When they get into a dispute or conflict, they always divide,
mm-hmm.
you see.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the first thing which, you know, was striking to me. When you have a dispute, you divide. I would, you know, go rather than when you have a dispute, you try to get together, not divide, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the challenge that I thought that should have been taken.
Is that how you feel today, or is that how you felt?
That is what I felt then,
okay.
1960
okay.
and 65, and that is what I feel now.
Okay.
And it was also what I felt in 1975, too.
Okay.
So, and then I was with the private sector, working for the oil company,
mm-hmm.
very happy to be a young businessman there, and suddenly I was thrown into the government. I didn't expect it, I didn't think about it, And I'm sure that many other politicians in Saigon would have liked to join the government. Mm-hmm. But I was, of course, very surprised, but also very worried. You know, I was just a guy 29 years old, mm-hmm. and to become a labor minister at 29, and no one had heard such a thing before. Mm-hmm. So what was my then, shall we say, understanding or knowledge mm-hmm. of the political, military situation, so, and then the social conditions of the people there, mm-hmm. you see. Okay. And what was the war? I did not have a very clear picture of the escalation of the war between 1960 up to 1965, except that the volume of petroleum products increased, you know, madly mm-hmm. because of the war activities. Mm-hmm. And as you know, Esso was the large American oil company, mm-hmm. Which was very responsible for supplying not only the civilian needs, but the military needs in petroleum for South Vietnam at that mm-hmm. time.
Right.
So, what was the kind of a war there? You see, I had the very clear, you know, feeling that President Ngo Dinh Diem and his family mm-hmm. and his government, mm-hmm. you know, they were repressive. So, but repressive in a way that the escalation of the subversive activities of the Hanoi government, you see, and it was considered as an action by the Hanoi government against the Saigon government. It did not come into my mind that the people in South Vietnam at that time, the Ordinary people, had any really clear reason why they should try to overthrow Ngo Dinh Diem, you know, although he became more and more repressive mm-hmm. and bloody repressive in yes. the end, you see, especially with his October 1959 law against mm-hmm. communism. Mm-hmm. Captain punishment for anything remotely related to communism. Mm-hmm. So that was the first question. Now, I would like to find the answer. Was it necessary for Diem to become repressive? I think it was not in his nature to be repressive, bloodily repressive.
Personally, not in his nature.
No,
okay.
He was a devout Catholic, a Mandarin, you see, but he was not the kind of ruler who would say that I execute you if you do mm-hmm. not agree with me.
Was
but
that new? Was yeah. that his brother kind of
yes.
implementing that law?
That is to say, the security network and the system was imposed there with the secret police and so on of his brother Ngo Dinh Diem, and everybody
right.
Knew that.
Right.
You see, and so my question here, as a Vietnamese at that time. Mm-hmm. It was repressive on the part of the governor. And how repressive? Repressive in what way? To the urban population. That was different
yes.
from the kind of repression you had in the rural areas, you see. And so, to begin with the people in the urban areas, that is the intelligentsia, the workers' union, and people who had more or less a better life, mm-hmm. you know, in the cities. He was repressive to them in the sense that if they don't support the Ngo Dinh Diem regime, they were in the opposition of the Ngo Dinh Diem, it was equated to communism. Probably the man did not, was not, you know, stupid to say that anything related to communism mm-hmm. is bad for his regime, or that anybody who was not for him would be equal to a communist.
Right.
See? But in practical terms, you know, Ngo Dinh Diem, and especially Ngo Dinh Diem, his brother, were brought to that kind of a position. And would they be legitimate to claim it's self-defense? Because people were using, you know, assassination, terrorist activities, to overthrow his government,
right.
and they would have the very legitimate reason to say that the government of Saigon had to provide security for the population. And then you had also other groups, maybe not very well known in the majority of the population in South Vietnam, but they were the traditional nationalist parties, the Dai Viet, the Working Dang parties, and so on and so forth. They were clearly anti-communist. But then they were drawn into the process of becoming more and more anti-Yim too. And they were outlawed too. And then Yim then would find it very difficult to say that the member of the Dai Viet or the member of the Working Dang party would be equal to communist, you see, and would be an ally of Ho Chi Minh. He couldn't say that, but he placed them also in the same group, you know. That is, to be anti-Diem is more or less to play into the hands of the communists, therefore you were also as good as a communist. So that was his dilemma.
Do you see that as a really big mistake that he made, or do you think that was where he
it was
had
clearly,
no choice?
It was clearly a vitally bad mistake on the part of Diem, and probably more new than Diem, you see. But then, was it possible for Diem to become what we would consider a liberal? You know,
right.
That is to say, calling everybody, you know, we have a fight together against the communists, and so on. Were they in a position, Diem and his family, you know, mental state, to be able to rally everybody? That would be the ideal thing for the U.S.
Right.
government,
right.
You see? But then, I think we have to put it again in the historical context of the whole world. It's not only Vietnam at that time. After the Second World War, you have the tremendous upsurge in nationalism and so on and so forth. And you had also some remnants, you know, of colonial rule here and there. And then you had also people who were involved or related somehow to those former colonial rules here and there. And they were what we would call the rightist, you know, groups,
yes.
You know, against, you know, the leftist groups that would be associated with the Soviet Union, with the People's Republic of China, and then of course with Ho Chi Minh and the rest. All right. But then, you see, it appeared to me that in those years of the 1950s, the U.S. administration, and then from the time of President Truman, and then Eisenhower, and then so on, with Kennedy and Johnson and Nixon, you seem to appear to be on the right side, not on the left side. And you seem to have a policy which was to consolidate, you know, the rule of those rightist groups almost everywhere in the world, you know. And then, although you consider that Ngô Đình Diệm was a good man, he was a devout Catholic, and then he thought good of the Vietnamese, for the Vietnamese people and so on, but more and more, you know, for me, who was in France and in England for all these years, you see, when I joined, when I was in Saigon from the 1960 to 1963 with the overthrow of Brandon Indian, I could not fail to associate, you know, President Ngô Đình Diệm more or less the kind of Batista, you know, in Cuba, or the Trujillo in the Dominican Republic. And that is the direction in which I saw him going, you see. Maybe he was a little better than the Batistas and the Trujillos,
right.
You know, but that's the same path. You see. That's the same path. And too many people, even in the intelligentsia, in the urban areas of South Vietnam, they have that feeling too, you know. In one sense, they have the impression that, you know, the Americans supported the rightist groups, you know, while they had also an acute desire to regain their nationalistic feelings, the independence and sovereignty from foreign rule, foreign presence, That was a big dilemma. And to me, as I said, it's like, jumping out of the window from a building on fire. So, but you had to make a decision. And I think that most of them in the urban areas, they had to go righteous, you know, and sacrifice a little bit of their nationalistic feelings and aspirations. As for the people in the countryside, I'm sure that they were completely in the dark about those political issues.
Did that matter, though?
Yeah, what mattered to them was to be left alone,
right.
Plow their little lot of land, and then feed their kids, and that was it, you see. And they were not very aware of what was communism, or not communism, or capitalism. I don't think that, you know, people were very much aware or clear in their minds what were those ideologies, you see. But they were also aware that the United States, you know, was instrumental in the victory against, you know, Hitler and against Japan and so on and so forth, and that the United States was very wealthy and very powerful and so on. But then again, in the global context, you may say that at that time, 1915, you had the Soviet bomb. 1949, you had the PRC. And then, here, we have to ask the question, for those Vietnamese, you know, in South Vietnam and in the whole of Vietnam, were they very much aware of that, you know, should we say, beginning of what later on you will call the Cold War, you know, which was a big and a very major confrontation, you know, of the global, in the global sense. I honestly say the Vietnamese were completely in the dark about that kind of conflict coming up.
Did that matter, though, that the Vietnamese people were in the dark? Maybe like some of the American people were in the
dark. So how were they made aware that there was a conflict there somehow between, you know, people who claim themselves to be communists, but that also that are fighting for national sovereignty and independence, you see? So those people in the countryside, they were much more concerned with their safety and security, you see? And then Ho Chi Minh and his group were very aware of that. And then they would say and do whatever would bring, you know, those Vietnamese in the countryside to see that they were the oppressed, the victims, you know, of those colonialists and now called neo-imperialists, you know, forces in the world, and they had to regain their national independence and sovereignty and so on and so forth. But then, the kind of struggle imposed on them, you know, subversion, assassination, terrorists, that I think that at that time nobody was very much aware of that new form of struggle, new form of fighting, new form of warfare, in fact, which then would eventually be known as people's warfare. I don't think that the people in South Vietnam were very much aware of that new notion of warfare. But they became part of that notion of warfare. And that notion of warfare was not from the people. It was devised, planned, thought out very systematically, you know, by Hanoi. That is, by Ho Chi Minh, Giap, and the government there. So now, the Vietnamese people would try to seek security, you know. And Ngo Đình Diệm was left with no other choice than try to provide security. And it was also in the long tradition of American values to come to the rescue, you know, of people who need that. That is to provide security. And that you would claim in the end as self-defense against what you call aggressive acts by North Vietnam against South Vietnam. And then we come back to the two Vietnams, you know, principle. I don't think that the people in South Vietnam wanted very much to have two Vietnams.
How about the people in North Vietnam?
In North Vietnam, I'm sure that they thought that they should have the whole of Vietnam to the Vietnamese people. And that's why Ho Chi Minh was really clever to put out, you know, the Vietnamese people is one, the country is one. And they keep on saying. But then when they sit down, you know, to any kind of negotiating table in the international scene, they claim their own sovereignty for the Democratic Republic of Vietnam in the north.
Right.
And that is the very basic strategic element in the Vietnam conflict. That is to say, you have never refuted their claim that North Vietnam, as the DRV, mm-hmm. you know, was a sovereign country, a sovereign state, and mm-hmm. a sovereign government. You see, so that was guarded, you know, there.
Mm-hmm.
So now, from 1960 to 1963, with the overthrow of President Ngo Đình Diệm,
mm-hmm.
I think nobody regretted very much the overthrow of President Ngo Đình Diệm's regime. For President Ngo Đình Diệm himself, there may be some people who say that he was a good person. He tried his best, but he was surrounded by bad people, cruel people in fact, mm-hmm. you see. And we wanted a change.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the justification for the Saigon generals to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Without that, the Saigon generals wouldn't be able to do it. See? And of course, to begin with, the American wouldn't let the Saigon generals do it.
Right.
And so, after that, it was chaotic with the so-called civilian governments up and down all the time. And in the end, who had the bright idea that the military should take over power with the army council? I doubt very much in my mind that even including President Kennedy and then afterwards General Johnson, mm-hmm. President Johnson, they would dream of having a military rule in South Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
It's distasteful to American values.
Mm-hmm.
You see, they were pushed into it.
Yes.
How? Why?
What
some claim it's the CIA.
Yeah.
Did the CIA I thought of it or not? Many people really honestly believe that maybe they did not have the idea to begin with, but they helped.
Mm-hmm. What do you think? You were there in that,
yeah,
in that
I
time.
Was there.
What?
And I, you know, for a guy of 29 years old, it was my belief and state of mind that whatever may happen in Saigon, you know, that kind of things couldn't be done without the Americans. That is the general impression of everybody.
So, this idea, one idea that's very popular about this time period from the Western point of view is, and also I guess from North Vietnam's point of view at the time, is that the Saigon government was subject to the whims of the United States government. How much of that is true? That they were really puppets? That the United States really was calling the shots at this point after 1963?
So here I would like to raise two aspects of the question.
Okay.
The first, you know, a moral question. Was it justified for people who disagreed with Ho Chi Minh,
yes.
and his methods
mm-hmm.
to be against him and to put up a desperate fight against
mm-hmm.
him
mm-hmm.
with nothing in their hands to fight against Ho Chi Minh? Even the French, you know, could not put up with Jap and the Indian food. So it was a hopeless fight, you know, for those people who disagree. But if we say that they are morally justified and they have, you know, legitimate grounds to put up a fight with Ho Chi Minh, you see, that is the first thing. I say they have. Honestly, I believe that you should, you know, respect, you know, even if they were the minority, even if there were general elections in 1956, you see, a political system and government under the claim of self-determination should respect those minorities, you see, and majority rule, you know, as we understand it nowadays, you know, until we find something better.
Mm-hmm.
See? And that's what I continue to feel at that time and now, that the very essence of democracy is not a matter of having a choice, just a choice, go to the polls, or that it is majority rule, waiting for anything better. But for me, at that time, and even now, democracy means, first of all, the protection of the minority, of those weak and destitute people to have their say, whether good or bad, mm-hmm. but they must have their say, mm-hmm. and you have to respect their say. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that the communist system rejects that, mm-hmm. yeah. even eliminate mm-hmm. any kind of disagreement and opposition.
Like in 1959 in Saigon, same thing.
Oh, repetition yeah. everywhere.
Yes. Yes.
So that is the first question.
Okay.
The second question was for the American intervention, you see, from first the Dallas mainly, mm-hmm. you see. Then was the United States, first of all, morally justified to intervene?
Mm-hmm.
And I think honestly you have to admit that even now you have to admit the United States government had the moral, you know, justification to intervene in South Vietnam.
In the interest of protecting those minority groups
yes.
who wanted to express themselves.
Yeah.
Okay.
And not, you know, claiming that it is anti-communism, you know, that is untimed the Ho Chi Minh and his group to overtake the whole of Vietnam and even to appease, contain the spread of international communism.
That's what the United States government told the American people.
Yeah.
This is why we're going. This is why we have advisors there. Yeah. This is why we have troops there, to contain communism, yeah. to protect South Vietnam.
Yes. And here again, you have to be honest. And if we are going to try not to put blames on anybody,
right.
But then to find out those justifications, because I think that those issues are still also very present now. So there, was it a real threat of the spread of international communism at that time? First question. The second question, was it a real threat to the security of the American people? Or was it just a matter of ideology, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then you kind of a Don Quixote, you know, you go everywhere in the world, you see, in the name of democracy and freedom, mm-hmm. and to fight against the enormous upsurge of nationalism everywhere. And now also, there's another question. Honestly, you have to answer it.
Mm-hmm.
Was there any desire on the part of Stalin and then Mao Zedong to spread communism all over the world? You see?
Mm-hmm.
I said yes. It was a very real thing. Because that was their ideal. They want that everybody in the world become communist. But then can you object to that kind of a claim? You cannot. You object only when they use violent means to impose that ideology on others.
The United States.
No, I mean the Soviet Union.
Soviet Union, okay.
Yeah. The spread of communism. So that is it. The spread of communism was not to see, you know, armies, you know, of communists marching on the world.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But then you cannot deny, you know, the people to have the right to become a communist according to your, you know, Western democracy
right.
concepts. But you were justified to take action against any violent means used to impose that kind of communism on the people, who in the large majority of the world were not very much aware what was communism or not, you see. But then honestly, would you say that the Soviet Union and Red China at that time were not, you know, helping the other ex-colonial countries and so on and so forth
mm-hmm.
to have uprisings,
mm-hmm.
take over power? That was their method, you know, and impose, literally. And they believed that they had all the right in the world to impose,
mm-hmm.
you know, their ideology on others, because there was no other a better ideology than their own.
Do you think, though, that there's a parallel here with the United States and democracy, that the United States was imposing democracy on the world and on people and encouraging uprisings?
So that's why we come to that question.
Right.
Honestly, you have to answer. Would the United States send arms and then, as they claim, that CIA agents would go to other countries, you know, provide money and armaments for the people there to impose, you know, Pax Americana, you see?
Like Afghanistan today.
Or anywhere.
Or anywhere.
That you know, would like to have your own regime.
Mm-hmm.
I said honestly, that, you know, the United States, you know, as a nation and people, they had no colonial motives, you know, to impose anything to anybody. But they were, you know, really motivated by the desire to bring, you know, democratic rule, to bring freedom and liberty to other people. That others would say that is Pax Americana, you see. But you would say that I just give money, I don't give arms. And I began to give arms only when the other side began to give arms to the people there. So who started the whole thing, you know? In the 1950s, I don't think that the American gave much arm to the people in Vietnam, you know, to fight against Ho Chi Minh. They did give something to the French, you know, mm-hmm. but in fact it was to give to the French to get out, because they did not understand at all the conflict there, and they were thrusted into something that in the end they said, okay, you need money, I give you some money, and that you do what you can over there in Indochina, maybe re-establish some kind of French rule. I don't know, I'm not interested yet. See, so that was probably Eisenhower who began to say to Paris, you know, if you continue with your colonial war there, you know, over there, it's very bad. You should go there and brandish the banner of, you know, democracy and freedom. And that was a bit difficult, you know, for the French to do, although President Eisenhower had all the good motives in the world, mm-hmm. but how you can expect, you know, a former colonial power there, mm-hmm. You know, overnight to say, now I'm fighting for democracy and freedom mm-hmm. in Vietnam. You know, you cannot convince anybody.
Right.
That is why they had to, you know, go home. And so, there, was it, you know, a real threat to the United States, you see, in that period of the 1955 and even a little bit before that, mm-hmm. until 1960, mm-hmm. that they intervened militarily or that indirectly through Ngo Đình Diem, mm-hmm. they intervened militarily, mm-hmm. which would then give the justification to Ho Chi Minh and his team to claim self-defense and fight for real nationalism as they claim, mm-hmm. you know, and try to get rid of what they call the puppet. But puppet there, you see, as I said, the first part, would it be justified, legitimate, to put up the fight against the Vietnamese communists? And second, puppet in the sense that you have to establish some kind of balance of power. And the more the Soviet Union and then the PRC began to send their armaments to Hanoi, mm-hmm. and then you reciprocate. Or was it because you could not cope with subversive warfare, the beginning of people's warfare, that you introduced, you know, a high level of conventional warfare? In the First World War, it was a war between soldiers, you know. Well, you have with Verdun, a million dead, mm-hmm. so the more people you can throw into the battle, then the more chances you win. The Second World War, it was technology, means, planes, tanks, much more than people. Why? Because you try to avoid, you know, having death, a casualty, so you use equipment mm-hmm. to prevent that. Mm-hmm. And so that was the fight between industrial powers mm-hmm. rather than just power and people. I would say that, you
okay.
see. But then, you see, Ho Chi Minh was very aware of that. He would have tanks and planes to fight against the Americans. And so, you must give credit to the man, you know. He devises something which would neutralize all your advantages and bring out his own advantages. And he had no other choice than to go what we now know as popular warfare. You see, that is to say, a complete rejection of civilized values. And that is to come to what has worried me, you know, for 3 decades. That is, you come to a point when even if you are so sure of your ideals, of your objectives, mm-hmm. would those ends justify whatever means you can use? You see? Mm-hmm. The West would not go with that. But in the end, visibly to the world, Johnson defeated his aims by using those means that he had. That is a bit of a contradiction, you know, in the civilized world position. So I'm still worried, disturbed for that period between 55 to 1960. Was it justified for Ho Chi Minh to fight against what he called the puppet regime in the South and launch his people's warfare? Was it justified for him to introduce bloody repressive measures which then defeated completely the raison d'etre of his government, that is to bring out nationalism, sovereignty and independence, and calling in the American intervention? And was it justified for the United States government there to reciprocate what they would consider an act of aggression by communist North Vietnam against South Vietnam militarily, and always try to avoid saying that I'm in a political dispute with you? It's not, you know, I'm just helping the little guy, you know, victim of your aggressive acts, and responded. And then why did the American escalate, you know, to that level? It was unbelievable that such a country called the Democratic Republic of Vietnam should have, you know, the whole, you know, might of the number one superpower in the world to use that kind of armament and at that level against such a tiny country. And, you know, in the end, it didn't do much good. And was it not the American, you know, falling into the trap, political trap, set up by Ho Chi Minh? Because he started really what we now know as people in warfare.
Do you think the United States, if it had not escalated in 1965 to massive conventional war, that if we had continued, the United States had continued to supply militarily, financial aid to whatever regime was in Saigon, and this is a what-if question, and I don't know how useful that is, but
it may boil down to the questions that former the Secretary of Defense McNamara tried to ask himself, probably because it was a matter of conscience to him. And I was really, you know, profoundly surprised that he could, you know, go to Hanoi and, you know, try to find out the missed opportunities to have peace between Hanoi and Washington. My complaint here is that the whole process then disregarded completely, you know, even a little voice from the anti-communist Vietnamese or from the Saigon people. That was the why of the whole war. But then, you see, here, we have to ask ourselves whether it is possible for someone like Ho Chi Minh, you know, to accept a compromise politically.
Was it possible?
Was it possible? I said that he did play very well in the game of compromise, because as soon as he set up his 1945 government in the north, he tried to get in to get the other nationalist parties in. But what was his purpose? His purpose when he tried to get them in is was to neutralize them, and then eventually bloody elimination of those people who were against him. And so I think that the general, you know, impression of people at that time said that he might have the right to be the leader of the whole group, because there was no one better, you see. And if he were the leader, he must know what he was doing, and if he claimed to be a communist, that might be a good thing too, you see, because there was no one else to say anything contrary. And then the second thing was that the nationalist ranks were so divided, could not put up a new united front against Ho Chi Minh. Each one tried to do whatever you know he was able to do against Ho Chi Minh, which was hopeless, of course. And they did not receive any help from anybody. Why the Ho Chi Minh and his group got then eventually help from Soviet Union and from the People's Republic of China. And suddenly you had Jim, and then you have the American behind. And so the more that Ho Chi Minh tried you know, to what he claimed, regain, mm-hmm. you know, the national independence, sovereignty, and so on and so forth. And so that's how the American escalation began. Was this justified? I said it was justified. But then you adopted, you know, the wrong means to fight mm-hmm. against that, and you fell into the United States, fell completely into the trap. So the missed opportunities for peace here, you know, don't ask the Hanoi people claim that they were prepared to compromise, even mm-hmm. to have a coalition government in South Vietnam, mm-hmm. and so on and so forth, mm-hmm. you see. Nobody believed in that, of course, is it? And history has shown that it was not possible in 1975 and 1976. The NLF was, you know, eliminated, you know, illegal very fast. Mm-hmm. But at that time, see, he claimed that. I think that there will be missed opportunities for peace, you know, in the early 1960s, yeah, even before the overthrow of Diem, and then right after the overthrow of Diem, instead of, you know, the kind of escalation that you saw mm-hmm. With the American intervention. Mm-hmm. And they were also very decent, those that escalation by the Americans, you know. That is the good guy trying to help, so he responded, you know, gradually. Mm-hmm. But that was not the way to fight that kind of war. The only missed opportunities you had for the Vietnamese people, mm-hmm. I'd say, was first to surrender to communist rule and avoid the 5 million debt and the 50,000 American debt mm-hmm. that was not necessary. And was it worse for the Vietnamese people to become communists in the early 1960s? Or, you know, was it really a threat to United States security? I don't think so, and nobody would think so, you see. The second thing is put up a proper fight against the adversary, that is, to destroy completely North Vietnam in 48 hours, as, you know, Ambassador Cyrus Vance later has said, you know, don't make the same mistake again, you know. That is what, in labor, you know, disputes, I have learned, mm-hmm. that is, you don't let the dispute rot.
Okay.
Kill it at the very beginning. Either you surrender, or you just, you know, eliminate your opponent. But don't let it rot and rot and rot and rot, you see. Mm-hmm. And so the Vietnam War was simply rotting more and more every day by a sense of decency, you know, from the American government.
Are you advocating that the United States should have taken decisive military action against Hanoi directly in 1965?
That is what you do usually when you go to war. That is, destroy the enemy, you see. Even if you can claim, I have no ambition, you know, territorially mm-hmm. in North Vietnam. But if you use, you know, violent methods, mm-hmm. you see, against South Vietnam, I must put an end to your, you know, war machine.
The Johnson administration was really worried, though, if they did that, that the Chinese would intervene, just like in Korea.
And that's it. If you can beat again the Chinese, they kept on trying to reassure the United States that they would not have crammed troops in Vietnam, provided there's no foreign troops invading their borders. And then you just look at the kind of armaments that they sent to Ho Chi Minh. Mm-hmm. There were just individual small armaments. Mm-hmm. They never sent big armaments, you see. And the crack armaments were done by the Soviet Union. And so there, you know, I think because it was not made clear what, you know, was the final objective of the U.S. administration, because you must admit that the Soviet Union, the People's Republic of China and Hanoi, you see, were also justified to think and that the Americans would try to dominate North Vietnam, mm-hmm. to extend their influence into North Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. So. Sounds like a lot of bad communication.
Well, I had the impression that because it was the period of appeasement, it was a period of containment, you see, mm-hmm. and I would like to know, you know, the very, you know, learned person who invented the bright idea of a proportional response. So they were always a proportional response. If you escalate, a little bit, I would bomb more, things like that. And so you can call it proportional response, but it's also proportional appeasement.
Did you feel this way in 1965? 66?
Oh yes, I mean, we could not understand why there was proportional response.
Okay.
If you slap me on the face, I slap you back in the face. You punch me on the nose, I punch you back on the nose. And you hit me under the bell, I hit you under the bell. But that was it.
And eventually, Hanoi wasn't able to hit you hard enough. You could hit them harder, eventually.
Well, it depends what was your objective, because you can hit them harder physically, but they was not hurt physically at all, because they couldn't be hurt physically. They were completely flat. You see, you cannot beat a dead horse anymore, And then when they hit back, it was not physically. They hit you back on other things. You were not defeated. In the battlefield, and that was the same thing, because Ho Chi Minh had also a similar experience with the French. And that was it. Okay, so then you would try to bring out more things which would be meaningful or helpful. I don't know. I try and let myself go like that. I don't know whether it's good or not. But
what's
I was very I'm still very confused on those things, because even now.
One more question before we take a break. Do you think there are any other motivations that the United States had for going into South Vietnam besides to protect what they were saying, protecting the small guy, South Vietnam? Do you think there are any other motivations, economic motivations, saving political face in Europe, anything else?
Well, first of all, that they were they had the legitimate concern of the spread of communism,
yes,
especially with the Soviet bomb and then with the
yes.
DRC and so on. But then, you see, they could not make the distinction, the right of a person to be a communist and the right of that communist to claim that he is legitimately using subversive and terrorist action to impose his ideology. And I think that at that time, that was very clear to many people, but it was not very clear in the U.S. administration's policy.
Right.
You see? And so you mix there to give the impression that I do not accept communism. You have the McCarthy situation in town. It's not that you were against communism. You were against the spread of communism by violent means. That was the precise thing that you should have explained to people, but they were not able to explain it, you see. And they should be have been able to explain it, because you have the Charter of the United Nations, you know. That is to say, for Ho Chi Minh to say to Ho Chi Minh, you have a dispute, but in the spirit of the United Nations and after the horror of the Second World War, we have all agreed that we try and solve, resolve our differences peacefully. You know, not to launch a kind of armed struggle like you are doing, and then use what you claim and very proud of saying that this is popular warfare, invincible. You cannot defeat popular warfare.
And that brings up a good point. Could the United Nations have done anything more in this crucial time period between 1955 and 65 to stabilize the situation?
Then we come to another question. How good was the United Nations at that time,
right,
and how good it has been or it is now? At that time, it was considered as, a creature of the United Nations. Because the Soviet Union was, not in position to have much a say at the United Nations.
You mean a creature of the United States?
Oh, sure. Okay. Many people consider the United Nations a creature of the United States, until, you lost crown with the Third World, and the manipulations of the Soviet Union and the PRC. And so that's how you also began, funding the thing.
So the United Nations, despite what happened in Korea,
and again, you see, Korea was an illustration, that the United Nations was a creature of the United States. You see? Okay. So that's not the thing. But it's better than nothing. I must say, that's the painful thing is the United Nations is better than nothing. But you can do better if you are really honest with yourself. That is.
But how honest can the countries of the world be when they're fighting for survival, when they're fighting for interests around the world? Is it possible, do you think, for countries to honestly say, okay, we don't want the spread of communism militarily, but we really don't want the spread of communism, period, because that means that the Soviet bloc would rule economically more part of the world, which would hurt us economically. Is it possible for the United States to simply let people self-determine themselves and their governments, whatever it may be, and let us sit back and let the United States sit back and just let it happen?
That's very clear. But then, you see, it has always, you know, bothered me about that. And the issues for me are a bit, different. The greatest merit of the United Nations, mm-hmm. in my mind, was the declaration that we will henceforth resolve our conflicts and disputes in peaceful ways. Mm-hmm. That's very good. Mm-hmm. The very big problem of the United Nations since its creation now is that you have never, set up, provided the means to effectively resolve conflicts peacefully. That is the failure of the United Nations. And the same thing with Ho Chi Minh and with Diem and all the rest and civil now. Mm-hmm. The Declaration of the United Nations, as I've just said, its credit merit is to call everybody not to kill one another anymore, but there must be ways to find a peaceful solution to our conflict. But you have to provide the means, effective means for people in conflict to resolve peacefully. How?
What are those means?
Yeah. So, we will come to that later. Okay. But coming back to Ho Chi Minh, if he had the real spirit, peaceful spirit, the spirit of the United Nations, he would try. He would take the bother to go and see Diem, because he's the great brother. Mm-hmm. It was not possible for Jim to go to him, but it would be, as the big brother, for him to go and see Jim. You see, mm-hmm. you're my little brother. Mm-hmm. I can crush you, but the United States will come and we have a fight. But instead of going that way, let us try and find something in the spirit of the United Nations to find ways for the Vietnamese people, to resolve their differences peacefully. And that's why he took in his preamble for the Constitution of the Democratic Republic of Vietnam, the Declaration of Independence, mm-hmm. Of the United States. Mm-hmm. And I have been telling the young Vietnamese now, who try to find a way of reconciliation with the communist regime. So, and then they put up all kinds of traps for the future Constitution of Vietnam. I said, all these things are very easy. The division of powers, how to set up legislative, mm-hmm. how to go to the polls, mm-hmm. how to elect your village chiefs and your president. But the most difficult, I haven't seen anybody, of the people who are, well-intentioned. See? Nobody has written the preamble of that constitution, like the founding fathers did for the United States. That is to say, we have always failed to go to share, the ideas, the notion of what we are, what we should be. We have never found really our national identity yet, you see? And if you don't know what you are and what you want to be and what you should be, you cannot write a constitution. You know, that's just a piece of paper to organize the government, that's all, you see? Mm-hmm. And that sense of nationalism should override any ideological disputes. I mean, 4,000 years of history is not, a fight between the communists and the non-communists and the country and the people and the national, concept, mm-hmm. of that nation will be there in thousands of years to come, even when communists and anti-communists have disappeared. Mm-hmm. And that is incidental. But now, are we able to know also if we have take the United Nations as a budding form of world government or world order and so on? Have we infused the people in the world who they are and what they want to be? We have failed that too. At least there are common denominators that you should, you know, make clear to the people in the world. Mm-hmm. That's what we are. Like the American founding father, this is what we are. You know, we don't want colonial rule, we want to be free, we want democratic, we take in everybody, everybody is the same, they have their own rights in the world to be exactly the same. Let's get together and make a nation. We should be able to say something like that to the Vietnamese with their own traditions and own customs and own values and own culture. You see, you cannot take the declaration of the American in the Declaration of Independence and put it in the Vietnamese Constitution.
Right. So why did Ho Chi Minh go to the United Nations, do you think? Why didn't he take that step?
Because at that time, the United Nations was the creature of the United States. He would go to the plenum of the Soviet Union, rather. And that's what he did. Mm-hmm. And became a member of the Comic-Con. Mm-hmm. There was no choice. That's not a choice. That's not a choice. If not, he would say, you know, if you don't give me that, I go to the Americans. And those Americans, if you don't give me that, I go to the Soviet. He didn't have a choice. He just went to the Soviet. I think if we try and get down to those things, maybe we find out the answers and help the youngsters now to make a choice.
That's the most important thing now to you, is helping the young people understand.
Yes, very much.
Young Vietnamese or young Americans?
Who else? Both American, and I just said this morning to the Poland's students, mm-hmm. for both American and Vietnamese, you know, young people like you. That's why I'm here. Mm-hmm. If not, I go back to my village. But then,
break?
Oh yeah, sure.
Okay.
But then, you see, when we move into that period of 65 to 75,
uh-huh.
and only when we clarify a little bit of those, you know, issues in the background, uh-huh. you can move meaningfully to the period 65 to 75. Why you have things then in 65 and 75?
Do you think that historians have skipped over? That people are not really...
You recall the facts and events? And you try to explain, you know, why Johnson did that, why Johnson didn't that, mm-hmm. and all that. But then, you see, we have to bring in, you know, all the elements involved. What the Vietnamese of old quarters thought, what the Americans of old quarters thought, and then the adversary. What did they think at that time?
Right.
And in the end, why it came out, that end result in 1975. There was no surprise to me what happened in 1975. Mm-hmm. And then I wouldn't tell you, you know, it did not affect me much. When I went into prison, mm-hmm. I did not have the guilt complex. I did not consider the victory of those Hanoi people meaningful in any way. To the Vietnamese people, they took over power, that's all. It was not a victory to me. And they didn't impress me. And I had the patience to wait 30 years to see that my ideas are still valid now. You see? You claim that you were better than us. See? And you have the right to have power more than we do, because you know how to bring, you know, a brighter future to the Vietnamese people. Mm-hmm. They did not. Your claim was lies. And that is, you know, the impression of the large majority of the people now, but they accept a lot. Now, communist regime or not communist regime, even now, they don't care.
They want their bowl of rice. They want their job.
Right.
They want their family.
But they now realize that whatever the communists promised since the 1940s until now, just words. We want, you know, a rich and a powerful country. They keep on saying that for 40 years. Mm-hmm. It's the poorest country now in the world.
Okay, let's take a break.
Okay.
And this will conclude today's session of our interview with Ambassador Fong. We'll resume next week. Thank you, sir.
In Paris, for the Paris Peace Talks.
Right.
And, you know, and we were very happy to meet again there. And there was also a small incident that while I was at the welfare ministry, there was a very nice young American lady there.
Mm-hmm.
And we called her Poo.
Poo?
Yes.
Okay.
And Mrs. Lodge always called her Poo, so I called her Poo too. And we went on very well during our Saigon, because I was still a bachelor at that time, and whenever there was a possibility to meet and to mix with other groups and so on, and Poo was there, and we went on very well. And then when in 68 I went to Paris, she also stopped her welfare work in Saigon and moved to Paris and took a very nice house just behind my house,
okay,
in the Neuilly area. And Mrs. Lutz was at Fong, why don't you marry Pooh, you know? And it went on for some time there, but we were just good friends. And that was it. So probably I missed the opportunity to live in Boston.
Have you had any contact with Pooh since Paris?
No. So afterwards it was too hectic, and she left Paris when I got married in Paris.
Right.
Okay.
Okay, so we'll wait for the day.
Oh.